The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On the podcast this week, we're talking about transformations. Companies moving from their original raison d'etres into new and unanticipated areas. We're looking at Microsoft's mobile phone, Google's car, and Channel 4 Television's online IP. Oh, and we'll have a dose of this guy.
I know I'm a bit nutty, and that most people will have to choose one.
Yes.
It's not my job to say you should choose the iPhone, you should choose an Android, you should choose it. It's your job, as it were, my job as an amateur blogger of these things sometimes, to lay out to people clearly what they might get out of it.
That was, of course, comedian and polymath Stephen Fry, who will be sharing his thoughts on Windows Phone 7 and many more digital devices. Joining me in the studio to experience their own metamorphoses are Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish. Welcome to you both.
Hiya.
Well, hello.
Oh, hi. So, Charles, what would you say is the greatest transformation in technology this year?
But I don't think there have been. Well, actually, you know, the Windows Phone 7 is a butterfly out of a caterpillar, as we said. You know, everyone who's had one in their hands goes, oh, yes, this is rather nice. I never thought Microsoft could make something like this. I haven't come across a person yet who said, bleh.
Oh, maybe if they swallowed the caterpillar and go, bleh. And Jemima, what's your transformation of the year thus far?
What he said.
Really?
Mm.
Well, I'm glad that we are all agreed. I'm glad we're all agreed. And you know what? The evolutions don't stop there. Gareth Jones from Flip has spoken with Charles about where the handheld camera is going now that most of us with smartphones have cameras in our pockets. What do they have planned? Keep listening for more on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First, here's this week's news. Windows Phone 7 was launched this week to much fanfare and media attention. Being a media organization, we dutifully went along. Charles, you gave us your impression of the device on last week's program, and so we won't go into that area now. In a moment, Microsoft's UK Managing Director, Ashley Highfield, but first, Charles asked Stephen Fry if it would be overstating it if he described Fry as singing the new operating system's praises at launch.
No, I think I'm very happy to sing its praises. I mean, particularly because of where it's come from. In a sense, you could say it's come out of the dead end of Windows Mobile 3, 4, 5, 6. Or you could say it's come out of it's a complete rebirth. I mean, it is, they've called it a reboot, a reset. And I think anybody who can see a large company having the humility and the vision to reinvent itself and to listen, essentially, to listen to people and to the market and not to say we're big enough, we've got enough money coming in from our guaranteed income streams, to you'll do it this way and like it. I mean, it's sort of what I was talking to one of the people on the development team, and he said, you know, we feel proud of what we've done. And it is a new experience, I think. I mean, they can feel proud of the Xbox. I think no one can deny that. It's a big, hugely successful platform, apart from the occasional screen of death this year. But that's gone, you know. And Kinect is coming, and it's going to be huge, as you know. And Windows 7 as a PC operating system, I think, is a very pleasurable experience, really, to be perfectly honest.
A bit surprising with Windows Phone 7 that they seem to be talking all about the consumers. They aren't making their usual enterprise pitch at all.
Hardly heard the E word, did we? I mean, of course it's there, and it's pleasingly under the bonnet. You know, of course there's Active Sync Exchange, but you start with the consumer and then recognise that enterprise is made up of people who are consumers. You had this ridiculous position where people had a Windows Mobile or a BlackBerry from their company and they had another one for their life. And that just affirmed this idea, which is such an insult to any human being, that you are a different person when you're working for us. You check your humanity in as you go through the, you know, security swipe of the office. And then when you leave again, you can be a person. And I don't think that's acceptable, really.
You reckoned it would be at least a year before we'd have a sort of idea about where this is all heading, who's really going to succeed as a result of this shake-up.
Well, yes.
What's your expectation of how it'll look in a year, 2 years' time?
I think that's one of the admirable things about this, is that if you remember in June 2007 when the iPhone came out, it had no cut and paste, it had no app store, it was closed to itself, but it offered all kinds of new things. And the market taught Apple. If Steve Jobs was honest, he would be the first to admit how caught by surprise by the success of the App Store would have been, by how much everybody learned from that. And I think it's admirable of Microsoft that they have they've said, look, here it is, it works perfectly, it's closed, it's doing it the way we want it to be done. Let's give it time. Let's see what the market, in terms of, you know, the SDK and its implementations, will bring. Let's do the odd over-the-air upgrade, and let's do some bigger ones when we see how people are using it. Because that'll be the key. It's what's so good is they haven't poured everything into it so that it does everything. And then they discover, oh, well, actually, people don't like the way that it does that. They've actually said, look, this is clear and simple. This is how it works. And if you buy into it, and it's hard not to. It's very likable, operating and, you know, sort of user interface. And you may say, oh, I wish you could do this and I wish you could do that. But you say that of the iPhone. You say that of a torch, you know, whatever device it might be. And I think this is exactly the right way to have gone about it.
And then a couple of years, where do you see it? Apple, Google, Microsoft?
There's so many false prophecies, as you know. As I said, challenge people to go back and look at the tech blogs of 2007 or even the ones in the beginning of this year on the iPad. Some people would be ashamed of what they wrote. Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely extraordinary misjudgments, really. I think Microsoft will be in it as a major player. I think it'll be interesting, as I say, when Hewlett-Packard come in as well with the WebOS. I mean, I think we're all, to some extent, aren't we, treading water and wondering what HTML5 will bring. It's not the new dawn exactly, but it just alters the focus of how apps are written and what they mean, and the distinction between a browser and an operating system becomes more and more muddied. And maybe that HP have done the smart thing. I tried to persuade people I know at HTC to buy Palm, because I thought that would have been a very interesting move. But I think Windows 7 is here to stay, and I think when people get hooked, as I have after a week, on the simplicity of it, the cleanness of it, you know, it's a really clean experience. It kind of makes you kind of smile.
Very calm,
exactly. And I do carry a lot of these devices, but the question will be, which SIM will I move into it? Will it be the SIM that my number everyone knows? And I suspect I will certainly give it, I think, a month. I mean, I was very pleased with the torch. I thought that finally they've got, you know, because the storm is so sharp. But if I were Jeremy Clarkson, you know, there would be nothing odd about him saying, oh, I really like the new Ferrari, and then next week saying, I really like the new Aston Martin. People wouldn't say, but you said you like the Ferrari, you hypocrite! You know, and I'm the same. I like lots of good devices. I mean, I know I'm a bit nutty, and that most people will have to choose one.
Yes.
It's not my job to say you should choose the iPhone, you should choose an Android, you should choose it. It's your job, as it were, my job as an amateur blogger of these things sometimes, to lay out to people clearly what they might get out of it. Some people may just naturally, instinctively like the idea of the very closed, simple-to-use ease of the Windows system. Others may prefer, almost ideologically, the slightly open-source nature of Android, though, to be honest, it's not, to call it open-source isn't quite right. And, of course, it wouldn't be. It'd be like saying, this is a car that can drive on both sides of the street. Because the other thing, I think, you know, the keys, as they become bigger and bigger, are privacy and security. And I think, because you go down this way, it's a lot more private and secure. And I'm certainly not going to start any scare stories about Android or anything like that, but everybody is aware that when you have so many devices, so many flavors of operating systems, so many different, you know, skins, so many different ways of pimping it and changing it, and a much less severe gatekeeper than the App Store gatekeeper, there is always the possibility that something could go rather monumentally wrong. I think Microsoft is certainly a good bet for safety, clarity, all those things. And I think a lot of people who've never used one will actually, and I say this as a lover of Apple, actually find an iPhone quite confusing. I know that sounds heresy, because there's so much, and because their friends have got so many apps on it, they kind of go, whoa. Whereas I think they'll pick this up and go, are there other menus underneath it? No, it's just that. Yeah. But how do I know? Oh, I see. It's just very intuitive, and there's a lot to recommend.
I'm with Ashley Highfield, who's the Managing Director of Microsoft UK. Ashley, Microsoft has a mountain to climb in terms of mobile. Why do you think Windows Phone 7 has a better chance?
This is a reset, and we have spent a lot of time really understanding what our consumers want from their phones and developing from scratch a whole new user interface, a whole new way of presenting information to consumers in a way that we expect and hope will make their lives easier, faster and simpler.
I noticed that you say consumers there. I thought that Microsoft was all about marketing to the enterprise, that the enterprise is where you've been strongest with Windows. Is that not the focus anymore?
Well, that may have been a historical focus, and certainly the enterprise is still really important to Microsoft, but the consumer space is as well.
But that still doesn't sound like an emphasis on enterprise, which has traditionally been where Microsoft has been able to use the fact that companies are using Windows systems, SharePoint and so on in the back end, SQL Server, and that they're using Windows on the desktop to be able to make a convincing case about selling Windows mobiles. Isn't that the focus anymore? Are you thinking that actually consumers are where all the smartphone market is now?
Windows Phone 7, I think, covers both of those areas. It's understanding, really, that people can't be stereotyped into either being a business person or a consumer.
Do you think that the previous Windows mobile platform wasn't consumer-friendly enough, that it wasn't able to develop when the iPhone came out and Android came out? It wasn't able to evolve quickly enough to meet the changes that those brought about?
The shift in the last year of people to using their phones for internet browsing, for e-commerce, for updating their Twitter and Facebook posts. This is a trend that is happening now, and I think, therefore, we've brought the right phone to the market at the right time.
In terms of the business model, the Google Android one is one where Google makes the money from serving ads to it. Apple's one is that it makes the money from making the hardware and the operating system. Nokia's one is where it makes the operating system and the hardware again. RIM is the same thing. For Microsoft, you're an unusual player because all you do is basically license the OS to other people. How can that be the foundation of a really big and profitable business, especially given the sunk costs that there are in having to develop it in the first place?
That is, we believe, a very good and solid business model. We will also be monetizing the Windows Phone 7 through e-commerce, through downloading of apps and music, and also through advertising. The advertising would come both through Bing and through creating a platform through which we could actually sell display advertising onto the Windows Phone 7.
What sort of developer interest have you had? Because this initial version of Windows Phone 7 has a number of things it's not including. Doesn't have Flash, doesn't have HTML5, which must limit what can be done in terms of the sort of interactivity.
I think the developer response has been phenomenal and it has exceeded our expectations. There's been 500,000 downloads of the developer kit already. And we will be launching with a really rich mixture of apps for the phone. And I think, as I said before, we are on a journey.
Okay, and what happens to all the people who, up to last week, were buying Windows Mobile 6.5 phones? What happens to them? What is their upgrade? And all the people who have already got a Windows Mobile 6.5 phone, where do they go? What do they do now?
Well, we will carry on selling the Windows Phone 6.5. And in certain business instances, it is a very compelling phone and at the right price point as well. So this is not saying that we are discontinuing Windows Phone 6.5. Windows Phone 7 is a new start for us, and it is a very competitive phone in the smartphone market, which we believe offers a very differentiated product from other smartphones on the market.
Charles speaking with Ashley Highfield from Microsoft and Stephen Fry at this week's launch of Windows Phone 7. So, Charles, how much of a transformation is this for Microsoft? Why are they moving into this space?
Their previous smartphone efforts, which was Windows Mobile 456, as Stephen Fry described it, were just lamentable. And what they've realized is that it's actually the consumers who dictate it, that they can't go to enterprises and say, hey, come and buy our stuff. And the enterprises don't then just open their wallets and have the money. Enterprises are being very slow about doing these sorts of things. And it's actually been the sort of pester power of the consumers within the enterprises who have made the changes. So that BlackBerry is used more and more in enterprises. Okay, that needs the BlackBerry Enterprise Server. But the iPhone has now made its way in. Even iPads are being used by big companies.
What was interesting was last night I had a conversation with people who were suggesting that the reason why many of these large companies are going into phones, whether it's Google or Microsoft, is because they see the future of internet. They see the future of the web as a not browser, not computer specific environment. So Jemima, how much do you think that this is a reaction to this idea that they won't be able to control using, you know, Internet Explorer 7 or whatever it is, they won't be able to control the web consuming experience if they just maintain only the PC desktop?
It's certainly an acknowledgement of that. I mean, I think it's probably a little overdue. if anything. I had an HTC Touch back in 2008, which was before the sort of app explosion, really. But I was quite impressed then with Windows Mobile, which I think is a fairly robust and pretty well-designed piece of software. It seemed to stand still for a couple of years. But from my brief exploration of the new HTC handset with Windows Mobile 7, it's actually got wow factor. You know, there's integration of apps on there and in such a way that it's clean and fresh and new. And they've managed to come up with software that actually looks like it's been designed. It's been designed by a designer, not just bolted together with all the elements it needs. I actually prefer it to Apple's OS. In terms of usability, I think it's really, really, really interesting. I won't be able to use it myself because I don't own a PC, but they're not really going after Mac owners, are they? But in terms of their market share and attracting the right kind of users and building a product that will increase their consumer base in the longer term, then yes, mobile is absolutely essential. It has to be very app-friendly, which this software is.
Well, you can listen to Charles's review of the device from last week at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Our next transformation, and indeed our next news item, is Google's decision to launch not a new operating system, a new service, or a new search algorithm, but a car. Google announced over the weekend that it has tested driverless cars in California and have driven over 140,000 miles with them so far. Using radar, lasers, cameras, and Google Street View, it's so futuristic. It is the future, people. To get around, the Google car will propel us forward in a way that potentially spins the highway code into paroxysms of terror. Charles, what's the story here?
Well, Google has been experimenting for quite a while. They've hired some of the people who took part in the DARPA Grand Challenge. DARPA was the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in the US, which is the part that gave us the internet once upon a time. And they've been trying to get people to build autonomous cars and autonomous motorcycles and things like that. And so they've been experimenting with them, driving up and down and doing, as they say, 140,000 miles. They say that there's all sorts of benefits, which is you'd have fewer accidents, so they claim, and you'd probably also use less fuel, you'll be able to do more car sharing in the sort of ideal world in which Google lives, in which everything is good and nothing ever goes wrong. The technology behind it is straightforward enough. It's simply integrating, which is really hard because you have to do these things in real time. And while it's very easy to say, okay, so you read the map, you do the GPS, and then you look to see what's in front of you, what's behind you, what's coming up on the sides, the actual integration of all of that into real time so that you don't, you know, knock cyclists off at junctions or go through red lights, that's really hard.
But at the same time, it's also really cool. I mean, honestly, Jemima, this does feel like science fiction.
Yet... Well, absolutely. It's hilarious that Google has to do it before yeah. people actually talk about it. But I was digging around on the interwebs, reading things. And they were testing...
Perhaps using Google search
engine. Perhaps using Google, yes. It's all a cunning ploy. 1977... In Japan, researchers were testing fully automated cars that only went up to about 20 miles an hour. The European Union has spent about $1 billion on research in this area, including a test in 1995 where a car went up to 110 on a German autobahn. I don't know what's more scary, the fact it was driverless or the fact that Germany allows people to do that.
There's probably all the cars behind it hooting, saying, get out the way, yeah. slow coach.
Yeah,
it's too slow.
Well, yeah, that may be too slow. But apparently there are already automated taxi pods at Heathrow. Has anyone noticed those?
Oh my, honestly.
Head to the airport, folks.
Oh, I'm going there on Friday.
And we're in Brazil, you know what I mean? This is, well, not the country, but in the Terry Gilliam film. This is
or insane. Indeed like Total Recall, where Arnold Schwarzenegger is driven by a robot taxi.
Yeah. Well, I firmly believe, I mean, look at the road traffic statistics, more than 2,000 deaths last year and 25,000 serious injuries on the roads. I just think in 10 years' time, it's absolutely inevitable that there will be driverless cars. I think we'll be astonished we ever allowed... so many free agents to drive around and cause accidents.
I mean, yes. I have to say, in 1995, I did do a test drive of a car which had both cruise control and distance control. So it would stay a certain distance behind a car in front. And it would, if there was a car in front, it would slow down just to keep a certain distance, a sort of braking distance. So those aren't particularly new. It's being able to figure out where you are and do it in real time, which is the really tricky thing.
I do miss cruise control, but we really don't have far enough in this country to go to use cruise control. But finally, on this week's news, the announcement from the top of Channel 4 that the online innovation experiment, the brand also known as 4IP, is to be dissolved and integrated into the overall online strategy of this public service broadcaster. Now, Jemima, tell us a little bit about the history of 4IP.
Okay, well, this was one of Andy Duncan, the former chief executive. This is one of his baby projects, and he brought in Tom Loosemore, formerly head of Web 2 at the BBC and head of digital strategy at Ofcom. So his mission was to have a fund that the government contributed to. Channel 4 said it would put in £20 million and invest that in a sort of VC-like manner, but with a public service focus into various digital projects.
Can you explain, because people do bandy around, I even just bandied around this idea of public service. What does that mean in the context of Channel 4?
In the context of 4IP, this meant projects where there may not be an obvious return on investment. They might not be money-making, but I mean, I picked out a few of the most interesting projects here. There's talk about local.com, which is a community news aggregator. So it's not something that will clearly make money. It might do eventually, but I think a larger, more traditional corporate investor would be looking for a definite exit at some point. But because it doesn't make money, that doesn't mean there's no value to it.
Mm. And it's sort of civic benefit, isn't it?
It's civic benefit,
absolutely. It's where you cannot
measure
the value directly.
And patientsknowbest.com, which is another 4IP-funded project, which is about reclaiming your medical records, which is an incredibly important issue. But it's not one that will ever make money and probably shouldn't make money as well. So it was about ideas, and I think it really captured a spirit at Channel 4 with the best part of its public service digital head on.
Now that it's being reintegrated, do you think that it has been a failure? Or rather, do you think it's appeared to be a failure to the organisation?
Well, they've done their best to make it sound like it's not a failure. I think it was ideologically and financially unsustainable given the pressure on Channel 4 at the moment.
So would you say then that this is purely a financial decision? It has nothing really to do with the overall online strategy of the company?
No, it is definitely strategic as well. There's a new chief executive, David Abrams, and he is basically pruning Channel 4 so that it's about core television programming. And although a lot of these projects are very interesting and extremely valuable, it was hard to see how some of them fitted into Channel 4's remit. I do think it's a shame, actually, because there are very few places where a lot of these projects could go to get funding. And that was a really important part of Channel 4 really engaging with developers and really talented people who have no support elsewhere. Channel 4 says that these projects, that they're going to stick to their commitments. So if they've already said they're going to fund them for a further 3 years or whatever, then they will. But I can't help but feel it's a shame.
And of course, in the news today, Jemima, we are also hearing about the end of BBC Backstage as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's not that it's being pushed off a cliff. It's more that it's just been winding down gently for a very long time. The consensus among the developers that I'm speaking to is just that it has come to the end of its road, really. It was a perfect project for a certain moment in time, but there's a need now for something bigger, something that is more of a combined platform for lots of different organisations. So as The Guardian has open platform, maybe there is a case that all of these organisations pool their resources in one place. But we'll have to see where those negotiations end up.
Well, we'll be hearing more about this over the coming weeks. But in the meantime, for more information on the rest of the news stories, head to guardian.co.uk/technology. When the flip camera first came out, it was a video recording revelation, a handheld device that could instantly drop movies into all kinds of social media experiments. Handheld, pocket-sized, and with a USB stick integrated into the side, it was citizen journalism for the masses. But now, in the age of the affordable smartphone, is the flip relevant? Charles, you spoke with Gareth Jones of Cisco, the company that owns Flip.
The question that we've been wondering about is when they're going to start doing the sorts of networking, integrated things, because the consumer side of Cisco, which is where Gareth Jones works, also owns Linksys, all the router people. So you'd sort of expect that by now they might start to be doing something where you'd have integrated Wi-Fi, things like that. And indeed, the cameras do now have a Cisco branding on them. But so far, the ones I've tried, because I tried a couple of weeks ago, no Wi-Fi. And there is the question, of course, that now the iPhone 4 does video, now that the old iPhones do video indeed with a software upgrade, Android phones. I began by asking what sort of gap that leaves for Flip.
On a successful product like Flip, what you basically get is focus upon focus on what's good about that particular genre from products that are convergence devices that really force you to think, well, what are we good at? What is our modus operandi? What's our raison d'etre? And our raison d'etre is ease of use, fun to use, and how to make video sharing ubiquitous and tremendously simple.
But, for example, compared to a year ago, Flip cameras still don't have external microphones, still don't have Wi-Fi. So you can't attach an external microphone to be able to do a bit of YouTube with close miking. You can't, having taken a short piece of film, say, upload it over your home Wi-Fi to stick it onto Flickr or onto YouTube.
That's absolutely right today. And that sort of feedback is what we've been taking from consumers. We spend humongous amounts of time and money keeping in touch with our consumer base. Now, what you're after is a particular opportunity or a particular growth area for the product, which we are going to walk into. If you've noticed on the new third generation Ultra, there is a port on the bottom of the product called Flipport. And we are developing a whole new ecosystem of products that will allow individual consumers to tailor or to accessorize their product. And products like you just mentioned, external mics, have been high on that list of consumer feedback. And you'll be able to see those sort of products with a flip port probably within from 4 months onwards. May even be in time for Christmas.
I've been, for example, trying out a product called the Kodak PlayTouch, which has got a touch screen. It has a jack so you can put an external microphone in. It uses SD cards, which you can get an 8 gigabyte SD card now for not very much. If you get an i5 version of that, it will do the uploads wirelessly. Time is not standing still for you here.
The great mass of people who want to buy the products don't want to buy anything that's over-specified. Camcorders bang technology into a tin box and then try to sell the benefits afterwards. Whereas what we are looking at, we are driven by our consumers. We take back what they want and what they would like to have in their products.
But the Kodak PlayTouch isn't, it looks very like a flip when you look at it. It's about the same size. But it has all these things, it doesn't need it doesn't need a proprietary playport. A flip port. It just has a jack that you stick a mic into. And it takes an SD card, which is, very much standardized and very cheap. So surely you're falling behind in that sort of way. I can't expand the amount of storage that there is on a flip. And if I want to get the data out of it, then I have to plug it into a USB to a computer.
Undoubtedly, I'm sure that the Kodak product is going to have technology soon that'll connect it with the Hubble telescope. But frankly, people don't want that. What you want and what you
see... They really want to have a less convenient way of doing it, seems to be what you're saying.
Well, what they see is much more convenient. Now, Kodak for the last 2 years have been trying to do a flip. And every single time they miss the three basic stools of flip success, which is ease of use, the flip out USB arm, simplicity, the flip share software that's on every camcorder and is PC and Mac compatible. So this current product may be, but their previous product was not compatible with all different types of either PC or Macs. Then their next product will probably be, again, a totally separate, unrelated product from not an evolved design which stems from consumer feedback. It basically comes from, oh yes, we found a factory that can make this, we'll go down that line and we will buy those and sell them on the market. All our products are designed with consumer input behind, based on what they've experienced to date with the Flip products. And the biggest part about their demand for improvement is not some techie bit of junk on the hardware, it's basically on the software. The software is what they find extremely important. They want to share the videos. They don't want to have fun or get an orgasmic experience from capturing it with face recognition. That doesn't matter to the great unwashed. What they want to do is capture moments, share moments.
If all the products that you make are done with consumer input, why haven't they had an external microphone jack, which people have been saying it needs for pretty much since they came on the scene?
There's a tiny percentage of people who say they want it. We have now facilitated that by saying, here it is with the flip port. So that tiny percentage wanted. We want people to share videos, facilitate it. The iPod, dare I say it, the Nano, might not be the best MP3, but its ecosystem of iTunes, the hardware, provide the easiest and simplest platform for enjoying and sharing music. That's the position we want to take with video.
Gareth Jones talking to Charles Arthur. Now, Charles, we spoke with Flip in July 2009, just over a year ago, and you can actually listen to that item on the blog. There's a link on the blog or on the screen of your iPod right now that you can click on. But they said pretty much the same thing, didn't they?
They did. It was Ray Sangster that time, who was the head of Europe, Middle East, Africa. And yes, the sort of implication was, that was when the Cisco takeover was very fresh, was that, you know, this sort of wirelessness would be coming and that it was all just around the corner. But haven't seen it. You know, there's been sort of HD stuff, and there is now this flip port on the bottom of some of the models. But as to the actual fruits of it, well, no sign yet. And though Gareth was really quite dismissive of the Kodak camera there, I have to say that I don't think he's seen the same thing that I've seen, because the Kodak software that I've been looking at is very much aimed at sharing stuff, and the camera itself is really very good. It's got an excellent lens for close-up work or for distance work. So I have to say that I think Flip has really got to get onto the game here, because otherwise it's going to be left behind, A, by you know, efforts by people like Kodak, and B, by all the smartphones.
It's a really interesting way to create sub-networks, ultimately, isn't it? Potentially with, you know, its router technology, with Cisco's links to that. But perhaps there's something to do with, I don't know, some kinds of regulation associated with Wi-Fi and network space?
I think it's just that Cisco isn't very used to consumer stuff. They're trialing a home video conferencing technology called, I think, UMI in the US. But they're not sure if it's going to work, and they're just sort of trying it with a few people before they see if they're going to take it any further. And They just don't have that confidence. They know what they're doing when they deal with big enterprises, and when they're trying to, you know, okay, we're just going to network China on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, perhaps somewhere else. But when it comes to selling, you know, the little things to consumers, it's a bit like the Microsoft thing. You know, right at the beginning of the program, we were talking about how Microsoft had to completely stop thinking about selling to enterprises and think about selling to individuals. And that's what Stephen Fry was praising them for, was the fact that they'd started treating people as individuals. And I think that with the Cisco takeover, that there's still some of that enterprise thinking, and they need to be able to strip that away and think about, okay, what is it that individuals want? How are we going to give them something that's really going to do it for them? Because at the moment, although the cameras are good, although the software's pretty good, it's not actually staying ahead of the rest of the field.
It would be a real shame if this was a typical startup story where a really interesting technology that had potential consumer focus was buried by a large corporation. But we shall find out more about this in the future. That's all for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Charles and Jemima, and of course to Gareth Jones from Cisco. Now, I'm away next week, but don't worry, you'll be taken care of, and I don't mean that in a kind of mafia-style takeout plan. All the links from the program and, of course, our Twitter feed, our Facebook group, our Flickr group can all be found at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The program was produced by Scott Colley, and I'm Alex Krotowski. See you in 2 weeks.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.